A new round of stimulus for struggling Jacksonville residents as plans are afoot to reopen the city, too. JEA gets a grand jury subpoena. And who did the Jaguars draft? We'll take a closer look. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week on our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later in the hour, Bold Bean Coffee Roaster is teaching us all how to make that perfect cup of joe while we're stuck in quarantine. Yeah, that's later. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another very busy week in the news, we welcome John Burr, North Florida correspondent for The Invading Sea. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. Our own WJCT reporter, Sky LeBron, is here in studio with me. Good morning.
Morning, Melissa.
And also on the line, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Hi, A.G., are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Good to have you. And lots to talk about this week, guys. Most of it, of course, related to the pandemic. The number to join us as we go through the week's top stories is 549-2937. Let's bring you up to date from overnight. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports there are now 29,648 COVID cases. That's up more than 1,000 cases from just a day ago. Reported deaths statewide are just cresting 1,000. Here in Northeast Florida, we have 1,562 reported cases and 37 deaths. And after weeks of lockdown, both Jacksonville and the state of Florida are easing towards reopening. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says he'd like to see a partial reopening of the city in the near term. What that looks like, we still don't honestly know, but at the same time, polling done both here in Florida and around the country shows that the majority of citizens are in favor of continuing social distancing and other measures to protect against COVID-19. Now, in addition to reopening the city, the mayor announced Thursday that some Jacksonville residents could soon be getting a stimulus check from Jacksonville City Hall. This is in addition to the federal stimulus money some people are getting in the mail. This local package would include $40 million in direct stimulus for households that meet certain criteria. This is according to the mayor. Eligible households would receive a flat $1,000. This is for households that make $75,000 or less and have lost 25% or more of their income to COVID-19. So as we talk about this, we want your calls and questions. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Sky LeBron, you covered the mayor's news conference. People have a lot of questions about this new round of stimulus money.
Yeah, mainly who would qualify for this. And I think one thing that was clarified yesterday, and it's a big thing right here, is it's going by addresses. So let's say two people work, they both make less than $75,000, they've both lost 25% of their income due to COVID-19, they will only get one stimulus check because it's all based off of one address. So two people in one household can't qualify.
Okay. And AG, I think people have a lot of questions about how they can apply, how they can get this money.
Yeah. And I mean, that's being worked out. I mean, it's still got to go through council Monday, and they're working out the details of the legislation on the press call yesterday. It's an interesting time for Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry. He ran as, hey, we're not going to raise your taxes under any circumstances, and small government. We're seeing this huge expansion of what government does. I mean, this is processing of federal money. But, you know, in terms of the payouts from the city, in terms of the economic steps, I mean, Lenny Curry's basically become FDR in terms of, you know, trying to get the spigot
right
going. I mean, something in this program, you know, it basically is a housing stabilization thing. $1,000 will help you pay your rent, you know, for maybe a month. So that's kind of how I look at it there. And they're just basically trying to keep things patched together so the economy doesn't completely bottom out because of coronavirus shutdown.
It's 549-2937 to join us. John Burr, not only does the mayor want this $40 million for local stimulus, he also really he's requesting $160 million total, more help for local businesses, and he wants to spend $35 million for an expanded COVID-19 testing program throughout the city. Now, Jacksonville was one of the first Florida cities to start the federal testing, which is ongoing. We are a little bit ahead of the curve when it comes to testing, but even still, we're only testing about 1 to 2% of the total population, which is about par for the rest of the country. And so testing and contact tracing, health experts agree, is the way to corral this virus and get us all back to work, which is the other big priority that the mayor has, right?
Well, of course. And, you know, we're in roughly the same boat as many, if not all, other cities in the country with this. We're all behind the curve in terms of getting out money to people who have lost their jobs. You know, I saw an interesting stat this morning. Florida has only paid 17% of the unemployment claims filed since March 15th. 17%, that means 83% of the claims filed in Florida in the last 5 weeks, nobody's gotten any money. So this, you can see why the mayor is suggesting, not suggesting, but pushing this $160 million local program. The state has just collapsed.
What about that? Let's talk about that, AG. You've spent a fair bit of time in Tallahassee covering the governor and the state legislature. The unemployment situation in this state is absolutely abysmal. It is just unbelievably bad. How many people out there are suffering and can't get any relief? And we hear about it all the we have had listeners contact us begging for help in trying to file for unemployment because they don't they just can't get through. They can't find the paper application. They are seniors who don't understand technology. And, you know, this is, I think, by far the most critical need facing Florida right now, getting unemployment relief to tens of thousands of residents.
Yeah, I mean, the program, the website that people were having problems with was designed in 2013, basically. It was a Rick Scott project. Rick Scott blames Charlie Crist for it, but you can basically see that this site was built a decade ago during a time of full employment, and even then people were having problems getting claims processed. The idea was to disincentivize applying for unemployment because, you know, Governor Scott and others thought that if you didn't have a job, you weren't trying to find a job. Now, fast forward to today, you know, a fourth of the state is basically unemployed, and you have a system that basically is leading to people starving, leaving people not able to pay their bills, leaving people making hard choices. And, you know, this is what happens when government does not run a functional safety net. Governor DeSantis has been ill-equipped to backfill on this. Ken Lawson, the head of the DEO, was handling unemployment. He's been basically kicked to the curb. Jonathan Satter, moved over from the Department of Management Services, is now running the show and providing accountability. But no matter how much accountability somebody provides, it does not put food on the table. It does not put money in the bank account. And it does not keep the creditors at bay. And that's the problem that Ron DeSantis and the state has right now. And it's got to be solved.
Sky LeBron, we keep covering this in Jacksonville, and we're getting so many questions from people about this new round of stimulus. Here's an email from Mike. He's wondering, what if a person A in the house has lost their entire income, but person B has lost none? The combined total of the income before the loss was over $75K. Can the one with the total loss get the check? I think that shows you, you know, people are so confused. They're unemployed. Maybe in some households, half the household is unemployed. They don't know if they qualify for any relief money.
Yeah, and I think that's something, those are things that might get clarified today and early next week as the legislation is officially filed and City Council will start to consider it next week. It's going to be interesting to iron out those details, but from what they explained yesterday, it does seem like it is very limited to just that one household, that $1,000. Nothing more.
Okay. And John Burr, of course, All of this, as AG said, is to try to keep the economy from completely bottoming out locally and statewide. Both Mayor Curry and Governor DeSantis have said they'd like to reopen the state in the near term. The mayor has assembled an advisory group of local civic and business leaders to informally assist him with that. We don't really know what this might look like and whether businesses would actually fully reopen. Some businesses might be reluctant to do that. We're really not sure what's next when it comes to that, are we?
No, we're not. But what we are sure of is that the types of scenarios that we were talking about just a second ago, with millions of people unemployed and businesses failing right and left and people not being able to afford their rent or their mortgage payments, all that is creating huge pressure on our leaders to open up. That's, you know, that it's more than just, you know, gee, can we get another $1 trillion out of the federal government? The real way long-term to get the economy going is to open it up. So that is the rub, you know. Do you open it up too quick and risk a second surge of cases, or do you keep it closed and potentially ruin the economy completely? You know, this is a terrible situation.
It really is. And different governors, AG, are handling this in different ways. Of course, up in New York, Governor Cuomo has pushed back on people saying, let's reopen the economy. They've said that the unemployment, the financial straits are like death for many. He pushed back and said, no, the illness is death. In Georgia and Florida, we've seen Governor Brian Kemp say he's reopening some businesses in Georgia actually today, like hair salons and gyms. Governor DeSantis praised Jacksonville the other day and pushed back against this Florida morons hashtag that trended on Twitter recently when Jacksonville got criticized for reopening our beaches. So depending on what state you live in, you're seeing a very different approach to dealing, you know, with the public health crisis and the economic crisis.
Yeah, I mean, and Ron DeSantis had that all-time great quote, you know, you may be morons, but I'll take you every day and twice on Sunday, saying about Jacksonville. That's one we can put on the billboards. Governor Kemp up in Georgia, I mean, his approach is too far even for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has said the last couple of days they did not support this, but it looks like Kemp is going for it anyway.
Right. He threw Kemp right under the bus.
Right. I mean, because Kemp's not following the guidelines. I mean, we sometimes assume that President Trump doesn't have a coherent policy, but there clearly are policy directives here, despite the things that Trump may say on the stage. Now, getting back to DeSantis, I mean, he has said that Florida is basically like five states in one. The issues that Southeast Florida is having, Broward, Dade, and Palm Beach, you know, are not the issues that we're having or that the rural counties are having or that Hillsborough is having. I mean, other than Southeast Florida, you know, the rest of the state is flattening the curve according to statistics, according to projections and all of that. So what we're going to see is kind of a phased approach. I've been following the governor's task force to reopen the state. They've been having meetings all week. And, you know, they're looking at bringing back things like elective surgeries in the next couple of weeks. Some hospitals are ready to go now, some aren't. You know, issues with PPE and all of that. So I think you're going to see some sort of staggering, because for a state this size with this much diversity, one size does not fit all, as the governor keeps saying.
Let's go to some calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. Let us know how you're doing out there amidst this pandemic, and particularly if you have questions about this new round of stimulus funding the mayor wants to issue to struggling people in Jacksonville. 549-2937. Jeff is in Mayport. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are we doing?
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I was talking to Kristen that two friends that I met, and they're crying about that their money, they never get a stimulus check because they hold the government maybe 1 year taxes or child support or some company have a lien. And the money, and they just scoop it out. I'm in a time of crisis like this. Well, the government, one side of the government gave you some money, But the other side take it. Like if you hold child support, if you hold back tax, these are the time when we need some help. We don't need to take no one money at this time.
Okay, Jeff. And how are you? How what's your situation?
Well, he's a friend of mine. You know, I checked him in the other day, and he gave me that. It break my heart to know that. Well, you know, he's not eating, so I got to share my money with him, which now I don't have no problem with. But that shouldn't happen at this time, you know.
Sure.
You know.
Well, that's good that you're doing that, and thanks for the call. You know, John Burr, we have heard so many stories of people who are just struggling so terribly, and you know, it's relief can't come soon enough.
Yes, and it's not coming soon enough to underline the point. So you know this, you know I. We've never, any of us have ever seen a situation like this. And, you know, what the balancing act between, you know, getting people back to work, but maintaining their health and society's safety, it's unknowable. It's unknowable. What exactly is the right course here?
Robin is in Riverside. Hi, Robin. Good morning to you.
Hey, Melissa.
Go ahead.
Sure. I was just really struck yesterday. I can't figure out how we can even get it back to our economy, even partially, when even our workers are not even provided even the basic equipment. I was at Lowe's on the west side yesterday, and a young man that was helping me at 6 feet distance, but he just looked so sad. And I said, what has this been like for you? And he said, this company won't even supply us the basic equipment. So this is Lowe's. So he didn't have a mask. And he says they don't have hand sanitizer, gloves, nothing. And he said, I guess all they're worried about is just money. They don't care about us. And that just really struck me.
I'm so sorry, Robin. Thanks for that. You know, Sky LeBron, depending on where you work, you're either being well provided for by an employer who's trying to do the right thing, or you're not. Yeah, you're at the mercy of your employer in these situations.
Yeah, definitely. And that's another thing that DeSantis hasn't made uniform across the state. It's been, I mean, Mayor Curry has constantly said when you're out in public, make sure that you're wearing a mask. But in terms of employers, that is not something that's been made mandatory here in Northeast Florida. We've seen it in other sections of Florida, like Southeast Florida and Broward and Miami-Dade. There's been a lot of companies that are saying, all right, now you have to wear a mask. That is not something uniform.
Lots of tweets. Here's one from Jim. I'm grateful my employer set up teleworking at the beginning of March. I can't imagine how bad it is for folks who aren't working and waiting for unemployment insurance. Here's a tweet from Nan. The government is putting the strain and the risk on Main Street. Corporate socialism thrives every day in the U.S., but now Main Street needs help. We're told to get back to business and make it work. AG, a few moments ago, you talked about the fact that the president and Republican governors and mayors are having to take actions that are certainly not in their ideological wheelhouse, their comfort zone. Huge amounts of stimulus money and support. You harken back to the New Deal, FDR, and what he did to try to help pull the nation out of the Depression. We never really did get fully out of the Depression until World War II got going. But, you know, this, I think, has really shown how the two parties differ in terms of how they approach the economy and how they approach the social safety net. And it has led to a really interesting discussion about where how robust our social safety net should be now that this crisis has shown how vulnerable millions of Americans are.
Yeah, I mean, and that discussion about what the safety net should look like, it really is decades old. I mean, if you go back to when the U.S. got off of Bretton Woods, got off the gold standard about 50 years ago, you know, back then there were things proposed like a minimum income and an expansion of healthcare, you know, Medicaid to basically include like more people, sort of like people want now. And you fast forward 50 years, what we've seen is giveaway to corporations, seeing wealth redistributed to the top 1%. We've seen multinationalism pushed over localism. And, you know, all of that happened at the expense of the working class, of people who are in the middle class, basically the frontline workers, the grocery store people, the restaurant workers, the people like the Lowe's worker that, you know, the previous person said sounded so sad. All of those people are basically bearing up the burden of a society that's been collapsing, not just for days or weeks, but for years. And what we have seen with this latest spending spree is expansion of what we've done since 2008. What George W. Bush did, what Barack Obama did, what Donald Trump did, it's always inflate the money supply, give away to the top, give enough to the little people just to placate them, and then move on. This ticking time bomb was set off 50 years ago, not a few weeks ago.
John Burr, you know, Andrew Yang, one of the presidential candidates, his whole platform was universal basic income, that every American should get a $1,000 check every month because so many jobs, he said, will be made obsolete, automated out of existence, and that we need a plan for that. What we're seeing now from both local and the federal governments is basically a short-term version of universal basic income, but it's short-term. It's one time only. In Canada, Canadians are getting $2,000 a month, all of them, for 4 months. That's really more of a robust sort of UBI effort than what we're seeing here in the States.
Yeah, you know, and when Andrew Yang first made that policy pronouncement, you know, a lot of people thought he was a quack. But, you know, it's just amazing how quickly that idea, now that we're in the first pandemic since 1918, that idea is suddenly mainstream and actually being implemented. So, you know, the world changed. And AG's right. You know, a lot of the scrimping that in the United States on social programs since the 1980s, that chicken's come home to roost, and it's a really, really sad scene.
Danny in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Danny, how are you today?
All right.
Go ahead.
My question is, okay, the federal government gave out a stimulus. They're talking about a stimulus here in Jacksonville. The federal government has done trillions of dollars in bailouts. Where's this money coming from, and what happens afterwards? Are we going to get taxed to death on this? Are our taxes going to go up?
Sure.
Where's the money coming from?
Yeah. I mean, AG, the government can print as much money as it wants, right? But I think taxpayers do have that concern. Will it come back around to them at some point?
They should have that concern because the debt just went up $2 trillion. And who is going to pay for it? That's the question. I mean, there's the school of thought that says deficits don't matter, debt doesn't matter, et cetera. But when your situation is predicated, as America's has been, on being the reserve currency for the world, and when we basically water down our currency, what's happening? We are creating a situation in which we are embracing insolvency move by move, and the money is basically coming from thin air. There's one proposal basically that said, well, just print up, just mint $2 trillion coins to pay for it. That's not real economics. That's funny money. That's voodoo economics, as one presidential candidate once said. And our kids are going to be paying for that. Bet on that.
Here's an email from Joe. The economy is a house of cards. What happened to the concept of an emergency fund? It's how our great-grandparents survived. Maybe this pandemic will resurrect the need, he says, for economic self-sufficiency. What do you think, everybody? Give us a call. Nick is in Palatka. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how you doing this
okay,
morning?
Okay, thanks for calling.
Hey, I think we need to get back to work. The government only has so much money. And just like the guy was saying before you, we're going to pay for all this down the line. The answer is not socialistic programs. The answer is to get back to work.
So you're in favor of opening up the economy, the state?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
The bottom line is, do we want to die from the disease, or do we want to die from the depression that's going to come if we don't get back to work?
Are you out of work, Nick?
I've got a nephew that was just laid off this morning from the railroad company. We can't keep doing this. If we didn't do it for the regular flu, we don't need to be doing it for this.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, but at the same time, this is so much deadlier than the flu. So no, that's what makes it so difficult.
Not by the numbers. It's not.
Well, it is, that's, Nick. That's it is. True. But and I'm not taking away from the hardship that you're suffering.
Look at the numbers of the flu. Look at the numbers of the flu.
No, Nick, I won't let you put misinformation on the air. This is more deadly than the flu, about 10 times more deadly. Now, that said, John Burr, his call reflects the economic pain people are feeling out there.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. And, you know, it's real. It's real pain. I mean, people, like I said, 83% of the people who filed in Florida for unemployment have gotten nothing in 5 weeks, and there's no promise they're going to get anything in the next 5 weeks. So, yeah, the pain is real. People, you know, we talk a lot about people living paycheck to paycheck. Well, that's five paychecks ago, guys. People are really hurting.
David at the beaches. Hi, David. Go ahead, David.
Hi, Melissa. How you doing?
Okay, thanks.
Hey, I just wanted to expand on what everybody's talking about is this trillions of dollars that we're borrowing and we're printing money. You know, a quick story. My grandmother raised my father and my aunt and uncle during the Great Depression, and they lived in a tent for several years. Mm. You know, I heard the stories of tumbleweeds being used for Christmas trees. My biggest concern is that what we're doing with borrowing trillions and trillions of dollars, it's not us that's going to repay that money. It's going to be our kids and our grandkids. And how fair is it to them? You know,
sure.
I just want to leave that there. It's going to be painful what we're all going to go through, but our grandparents did it. We can do it.
You know, I appreciate you bringing that up, David. AG, my grandparents are gone, but they were young adults in the Depression, and it scarred them. That whole generation was so scarred and traumatized by living through that. I mean, I remember my grandmother, she was on the verge, almost quite, but not really all the way, of being a hoarder. She never threw anything away. I mean, if she had some Reynolds wrap, some tin foil in her kitchen, if there was even a tiny little scrap of it left on the roll, she would fold it up and save it just in case she might need it later for something. That was how scarred they were by the Depression, because they literally had nothing. And so after they passed away and my aunt and uncle went in to clean out their house, there was so much stuff that they had squirreled away in drawers and closets and in the things they didn't need at all, but they just could not let go of things because they had such a scarcity mindset all their lives. And I think the caller makes a good point that, you know, they survived that experience, but with a lot of trauma. And the fear is that we're heading into this kind of situation again, and we're going to scar a whole new generation of young people where they're coming of age in this nightmare. It's not good.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at your typical 21-year-old right now, they've lived through 9/11, two major economic downturns. This one looks to be worse than 2008 by far, and a lot of instability. But, you know, we're coming out of an era of conspicuous consumption. We're coming out of an era where we bought so many disposable things and so on. And, you know, I think there was bound to be a return, you know, sort of this post-globalist landscape that we're looking at, you know, to people having to conserve a little bit more, to use less plastic, to be more careful and mindful of the environment and of things, and of stewardship. I mean, these are lessons that people learn when they have to, not because they want to. And that may be a consequence of this, but it's going to happen at the expense of a lot of people starving, a lot of people living in their cars, and a lot of people, as you correctly pointed out, being traumatized in a way that's going to be generational.
Sky.
Yeah, I think when AG brought up, this is a lot of 21-year-olds have experienced. I'm 23 right now, and I've seen a lot of this stuff. My brother who is a little bit older than me, graduated during the 2008 recession. And that was a scarring moment for him as well. So I'm talking to my friends in college who are graduating right now, and they are really concerned about if there's even going to be a job market to go to once they graduate. It's definitely been a scarring moment for a lot of us.
Yeah, for sure. Wes in Jacksonville. Hi, Wes. Go ahead.
Hey, love the combo. Love the show as always, Melissa. Thank you.
Thank you.
My grandfather raised me, and he died about ago. And he told me before he died, he said, "Son, there's two things that you need to know. One is a severe economic downturn, and he said the other is some type of pandemic, because neither have happened in my lifetime."
Oh, he was a smart man, wasn't he?
The depression and
right.
He was brilliant, really. And, you know, they were, you know, when I was young, we farmed, and my wife and I have talked.
Yeah, we lost you there, Wes. But I think you were going to talk about getting more into farming your own produce, which, by the way, I want to mention that Publix announced this week it will purchase fresh produce and milk to help farmers who have been hurt by the coronavirus pandemic. They're going to donate these products to Feeding America member food banks in the communities they serve, like Feeding Northeast Florida. This will help support Florida produce farmers, dairy farmers, and people looking to the food bank for food. This is going to run for several more weeks, so keep your eye on that. And if you're just tuning in, it's our media roundtable with Sky LeBron, John Burr, A.G. Gankarski, and yours truly. And we do want to move on now and talk about another big, big story from the week. Did you hear about this? JEA got served Wednesday with a grand jury federal subpoena. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Florida wants records from the utility about its failed push to sell itself off to a private company. Now, here's Jacksonville City Councilman Rory Diamond reacting to the subpoena.
People will be indicted. You don't send a subpoena that's detailed as that one, as focused as that one, if you don't have a pretty well-formed case and an expectation to eventually unseal some indictment.
Okay, 549-2937 to talk about the JEA federal subpoena. John Burr, they've requested a number of documents from the utility. They've also requested documents reflecting any communication on encrypted messaging apps like Confide between any member of the mayor's office and JEA's leadership team and board members.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, the question in my mind has always been, was this scheme purely hatched within JEA, or did the cooperation and guidance of City Hall also play a role? And obviously, from what we're learning about this, the subpoenas, that's a big question with the federal prosecutors also, and that's going to be what I'm looking at as this process unfolds.
Yeah, AG, what do you make of Councilman Diamond's remarks that he thinks it's a safe bet indictments will be unsealed given how wide a net the feds are casting on this thing?
Well, I mean, he's running the council investigation. So, he's got to have some inside knowledge. I mean, he's a former federal prosecutor, so he knows how this goes. I mean, the subpoena seemed to target people inside JEA, the senior leadership, past, and, some present. Melissa Dykes was mentioned, Aaron Zahn, former CFO Wanamaker, and so on. You have to assume that Diamond knows things that he's not divulging to the media. I mean, he's been crafting this narrative. The mayor's office, is aware of him crafting a narrative, and it's been kind of interesting to watch the sort of infighting, because you go back to campaign season, Diamond was pretty much walking in lockstep with the Curry administration. So I'm interested to see how this plays out, both in terms of the investigation and the politics thereof, because there are a lot of wrinkles in each.
And what to make of the federal authorities requesting communication on the encrypted messaging app Confide? That's a popular app that people use when they want to communicate under the table. They don't want a paper trail. It turns out, though, that the federal authorities can create a paper trail out of those messaging apps. There are security holes in them.
Yeah, and I think a lot is going to be found there in terms of, you know, transitional, you know, communications, like basically, you know, the sort of connective tissue of the other thing. So I'm curious to see what comes out of those documents. In some sense, I don't think it's going to be as much as people expect, but, I mean, clearly there's something there. Clearly these apps are used for something in the communication process. And, you know, it's probably to fill in the variables that people don't exactly know right now.
Now, John Burr, the ousted CEO of JEA, Aaron Sahn, was denied a golden parachute, a big financial payoff to go away. I think a question many have is, will Aaron Sahn tell what he knows about this scandal to the feds? Will he give up information?
Well, you know, that's a tried and true tactic of prosecutors everywhere is to what is called is flipping, to threaten people with you know, very long prison sentences, and a way to avoid those prison sentences or cut them down is to tell what you know about who else was working with you in your illegal activities, and it's usually used to get to the higher ups. You know, whether that's will happen in this case, you know, it's just conjecture, but certainly prosecutors everywhere use that tactic.
And AG, what to make of the mayor's statement about all this, that he'd never heard of the messaging app Confide, that he's saying he doesn't even know what it is?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, I guess we can take him at his word on that. I mean, you know, it seems like people in a circle might have known what it is, so maybe he just didn't have those conversations. But, you know, this kind of points out the optics of having these, you know, everyday press conferences on live TV, because, you know, he's been getting political capital off these press conferences, you know, leading the city through COVID-19, but other news is cropping up right now. And yesterday's was dominated by JEA questions, and they were difficult to answer. And, you know, that's kind of the problem with having the emergency management strategy of communications is once the emergency lapses, as Governor Rick Scott found out a couple times, real questions come back in. And, you know, that's kind of where we are with this right now. So I'm curious to see if the mayor's communication strategy changes in light of this.
Yeah. And going beyond the mayor's office, let me just be clear on what they're seeking. This is a wide-ranging request, or not a request, it's a subpoena from federal authorities. They have to give it up. Federal investigators want records related to the controversial bonus plan that Sahn and his executive team put together. That cost all of the ratepayers about $10 million, just their failed attempt to do that, where they were going to award themselves hefty bonuses. They want records related to a special event tied to innovation that JEA and the Chamber of Commerce organized. Sahn paid the chamber $25,000 and told them to use the money to hire a guy named Dino Hicks, a lobbyist who had an undisclosed business partnership with Sahn on a West Side property. So, John Burr, they are really seeking all of the records related to this. I think it's wider ranging than maybe some observers of this expected.
Yeah, and the specifics in the indictment tell you a lot about what they know already. So, you know, the feds have been working on this at least since December. We're now getting it almost into May, so they've had their time and they've used that time to really drill down. They know a lot. Now, you know, whether all the things they think they know pan out and result in criminal charges or indictments, you know, that's yet to be seen. But, you know, from all I can see, Aaron Sahn is going to be indicted. I mean, I think that's a foregone.
You do. AG, do you agree?
You know, I can't speculate on that. You know, but Sahn is definitely at the center of all this. You know, and really when I look at Zahn, you look at his meteoric rise from junior board member to CEO, or to interim CEO to CEO, like basically very quickly. I think you're going to be looking at how that rise happened also. I think that's going to be a question. I'm curious about Kerry Stewart and all of this, the former Curry chief of staff who moved over to JEA, and basically, I think she's going to be responsive to some part of this too, because, she was part of both shops. And I think that's what is going to come out in this, and something that Councilwoman Randy DeForest said is, this might be going back a few years. So, I think there's going to be that longitudinal view of the whole thing. It's not going to just start with the, call to sell JEA from Petway a couple years ago. Mm. I think it's going to go back farther than that.
Well, we'll keep watching it. Meanwhile, let's touch on just a couple of other news and notes from the week. The Duval County Public Schools got a nice windfall. A high-powered trio of attorneys say they won't charge the school board for legal fees over the big battle to get the half-cent sales tax referendum on the ballot. You, the voters, will decide that this fall. So that saves the school board a pretty penny. And did you watch the draft last night? Virtually, the Jaguars used their 9th overall pick in Thursday night's first round of the virtual draft to select former Florida cornerback C.J. Henderson. He'll fill the void left by Jalen Ramsey and A.J. Bouye, who were traded. Jags GM Dave Caldwell calls Henderson the best pick the team has made in a long time. He's a Miami native and was rated as the second highest cornerback in the draft behind a couple of other guys who we won't discuss here. Let's just talk quickly about C.J. Henderson. Sky LeBron, your thoughts.
Well, the Florida alum here, so a little bit of bias. But last year, there were some injuries and things that happened in the defensive backfield for the Gators. And C.J. Henderson, the last 2 years, has been thrust into that number one role. He had to guard some of the best wide receivers in the SEC, and he was great. So he's a long, lanky guy. I think he's going to fit really well in a rebuilding Jags system.
AG.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about Henderson as a tackler necessarily. I mean, he seems like a finesse guy. And, I just wonder about the pick. But, the measurables are fine. Best available Gator is the classic Jaguar drafting style, et cetera. Jury's out on that. I like the pick at 20 also. Another need pick, but they're going to have to address some offense today, in rounds 2 and 3.
And John, did you watch the virtual draft?
I did. Yes, you bet I did. I understand why they went for two defensive players. I think to get their fan base jazzed, though, they should have gone for some explosive offensive players. That's just my thought, but nobody pays me to draft football players.
So. We can't pay you guys, but we value your punditry here on this show every week. So thank you, John Burr, A.G. Gankarski, Sky LeBron. Guys, thanks for being with us.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Up next, how Bold Bean Coffee Roasters is helping you make the perfect cup of joe right at home. That's next.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Cavendish Partners PA and Michael Cavendish, a law practice supporting Jacksonville's business community, downtown, by appointment, and on the web at cavpartners.com. WJCT will be upgrading its radio antenna this weekend, so we will be temporarily off the air, beginning at 11 p.m. Saturday night until early Sunday morning. During that time, you can listen to WJCT's radio services online at wjct.org/listen, on the WJCT app, or on your smart speaker. We apologize for any inconvenience.
I'm Ira Flatto. This week on Science Friday, virologist Paul Offit talks about the risks of working too quickly to develop a corona vaccine without adequate time for testing.
When you're talking about trying to get a vaccine out there in 1 to 2 years, you're definitely talking about skipping parts of this process.
And we celebrate 30 years of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT. Too soon?
I think it's too soon.
Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp unexpectedly finds himself under fire from President Trump. Also making headlines this week, Dr. Rick Bright, Skylar Herbert, and the mayor of Las Vegas. I'm Sarah McCammon. We'll find out why on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, many food and beverage businesses have had to pivot sharply in order to stay open during this pandemic. Local coffee roaster Bold Bean is one of them. Their three storefront locations are all takeout only right now. But here's something else they're doing. They've started offering virtual classes and Instagram live conversations on all things coffee. That's one of my favorite foods or drinks. And they're even teaching you how to make the perfect cup at home. Zach Burnett is managing partner and green buyer at Bold Bean Coffee Roasters, and he's on the line. Hi, Zach.
Hey, how are you?
It's so good to have you. So you're teaching us how to make better coffee. What could be better than that right now? Tell me what you're doing.
Yeah, so, a really big part of our business is reaching out with our customers and just the experience of coming in the shop. And since we can't really have that now, one thing that we wanted to do was kind of bring the shop to you. So we've got baristas and other representatives of our company just kind of getting out there and teaching you how to make a really good cup like you would have in one of our locations.
So we can make something almost as good as your coffee, right? But not as good as if you made it.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty close.
Really? So do we have to buy your coffee? Will you deliver? How does it all work?
Yeah, so we're doing, we have, even before all of this came about, been doing online retail. So you can go to our website, boldbeancoffee.com, and buy coffee, and it gets delivered right to your house, typically the day after it's roasted. And you can also pick up coffee at any of our locations. And, we really just want to teach people how to make a good cup when they get it. It's not really hard to do, but if you follow a few tips, you'll do a really good job.
Now, your first class is actually sold out for today. Is that right?
It is, yeah. And that's a coffee cupping class. It's just how to, taste coffee and really differentiate the different nuances between the different coffees we offer. And, it was pretty limited access, and it sold out within a few hours. And it's something that we plan to offer more of in the future.
That's great. And people can keep checking back at your website to catch the next one. It's boldbeancoffee.com. Now, you're also doing some Instagram live segments. Tell us about that.
Yeah. One thing that we thought about when we kind of had to change our business model is so much of our business revolves around the experience of coming in the shops and kind of the culture that surrounds our shops and comes out of our business. And we're still able to deliver a product to people, but one thing that we're really missing out on is being able to deliver that experience of people coming in the shop. So we started brainstorming, thinking of ways we could do this, and really we just wanted to kind of have the same conversations that people can have over our bar with the barista when they come in every morning, but just through this different platform that everybody has in their hand all the time. So we're really looking to get those same conversations just into your house since you can't come into the cafe every day.
Right. You can do a virtual coffee house. And are you having one today?
Exactly.
Is that right?
We are, yeah. Today at 10.
In 5 minutes.
Today at, in 5 minutes, actually. we're having a conversation with one of our production staff, a guy named Jeremy. And he's just going to tell us about some of the things that he does in the community and also here at Bold Bean.
So people just need to find you on Instagram in about 5 minutes and be part of that virtual coffee house conversation. And then you've got more planned. You're going to give us a behind the scenes look at how you roast the coffee. That's next week, right?
Yeah, Wednesday at, I believe it's 11 a.m. I'm going to take everybody on a virtual roasting tour. So we're going to just kind of do a walkthrough of our roasting location, show everybody, you know, what it looks like in here for one thing, and then kind of just what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think people love that behind-the-curtain stuff. Now, this is cool, too. You are still giving coffee donations to first responders at a Bold Bean. Tell me about that effort.
We are. So we've had some just really good outpouring from a lot of our customers and regulars. And we had a customer who came in and donated $1,200 and wanted 1,000 of that to go to first responders for coffee beverages and food and whatever they come in and order. So we're still doing that right now. If you are a first responder, you can just call any of our locations, tell us your order, and we're going to charge it to that that account that one of our customers set up for that. So, yeah, it's a really nice way that we can just kind of pay it forward.
That's so great. Now, you can get your food and coffee to go from Bold Bean right now at boldbeancoffee.com. You can check out their virtual cupping classes. The first one today is sold out, but they have more planned for next week and beyond. And hop onto their Instagram today at 10 o'clock in about 3 minutes for their Instagram live conversations. And you can feel like you're in the coffee house, even though you're really not there yet. Zach Burnett, managing partner at Bold Bean Coffee Roasters, love your place and love what you're doing. Thank you so much for keeping the coffee hot for us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Again, that's boldbeancoffee.com. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Jessica Palumbo is 89.9's news director. Our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. You are also a big part of what we do every single day, so keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Keep in touch. Keep calm. Keep flattening the curve. And keep listening to 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.